I'd shared in the afternoon, my sponsor and I had done a history workshop in the morning, and it was a real special time. It's a fairly young fellowship. This was like their second or third convention, and it reminded me a lot of NA when I came around. Just like the first time I came up here reminded me a lot of NA when I first came around. And I don't really remember the first time I was up here. I know I spoke up here in 86 in the cafeteria. We had a convention here that was an alternative convention to the World Convention in London. And that was a neat time for me. That was a special trip for me because I broke down on the way, and one of those, you know, little coincidences that aren't coincidence that happened. And it's a really neat story. And I always associate that story with Ripley and with Cedar Lakes. It's on the way up, I was living in Atlanta at the time, and on the way up on the interstate in Knoxville, Tennessee, my car just died. Everything went to zero. No power, no nothing, and it died. It just died. And we coasted off the interstate and, you know, for somehow tried to start it. Eventually it finally started. We made it to this little obscure little parts place, junkyard, and the guy who ran it wasn't there. So we were waiting for him to come back to see if we could figure out what was going on, because I am not a mechanic. And my wife and I and my kids were sitting in the car, and all of a sudden I hear someone say, "Hi, Greg," and it was an NA member who had stumbled into this obscure parts house. And we ended up, got my car started again, made it over to his house. I spent the night at his house. They asked me to share at some kind of a thing they were having there, so I shared. Someone who was there when I shared managed an auto dealership and gave me a test drive from Knoxville to Ripley, West Virginia and back. I got home. Finally, we got back to Knoxville. I turned in that test drive. Walked over to my car, put our stuff in it, turned the key, and everything was fine. Didn't have another problem with it for months. You know, and you scratch your head and saying, how can that happen? How can that happen? But those are the things that happen in our lives all the time. Those are the sorts of things that we want to discount, but are really, to me, evidence of the presence of a loving God. After that convention in Tijuana, I spent a week or almost a week up in Los Angeles. On Wednesday, not this past way, but Wednesday week, 10 days ago, I had dinner with my sponsor. We went to a meeting, and he gave me my 25-year medallion. And that was real special. Part of that, and part of the reason I share that, is that's part of my program. You know, I made the effort to reach out. I made the effort to go to California because that was important for me. And it was a special time. We got home and got ready, came up here. I came up here today, and it was real pretty coming up here. But that's what it's been like the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks before that, 3 weeks before that, whatever it was. What was it, 2 or 3 weeks before that? The beginning of first weekend this month, I was in West Virginia whitewater rafting going, I think I've made a serious mistake. About the third time I swam. And thinking about, the last time I did this, I was 35 years old. One of the things, a while back somebody asked me what the biggest difference is between me now and me 25 years ago, and 25 years ago I was 23. And I'm 48 now, and that's a big difference. And I don't work the same way I used to work. And that was an exciting time. What's it like to have, somebody asked me tonight, what's it like to have 25 years clean? I don't know. I got 25 years clean, but I don't have anything to compare it to. You know, I've been clean more than half my life. I got what I got. I got what I got. Some days it's pretty good. Some days you don't want to be in the same state with me. I have defects of character. If you hang around me long enough, they will shine on you. And that's something I've learned about NA members. I've never met a single solitary NA member that didn't have defects of character. And if you hang around them long enough, the defects are going to shine on you. But it's okay. You know, because we accept each other with our defects. This is the only place in the world where people have loved me because I was an addict, not in spite of the fact that I was an addict. And it still is the only place in the world where that happens. You love me because I'm an addict. You love me because I came from the same shithole that you came from. The same misery you came from, the same loneliness you came from, the same emptiness you came from, and the same fear you came from. We have that in common. And we love each other because of it. You know? And it's real special. We get to touch spirits. I'm in love with Narcotics Anonymous, and that's just as strong now as it was during my first year. I don't know. I consider myself extremely fortunate. I'm not one of these folks that has floated away from Narcotics Anonymous, although I know that it's difficult to keep recovery a number one priority when staying clean doesn't seem like a problem. And staying clean has not seemed like a problem for a long time. And there have been times when I have struggled to keep recovery a number one priority. And I know it's necessary. My using, I don't like to talk about my using that much. I started using when I was 6 or 7 years old by prescriptions. I was a fat kid. They gave me speed. I loved it. I could not make a prescription last the length of time it was supposed to last. The medicine cabinet was fair game. If one did X amount of good, then two did 2X amount of good, and three did 3X amount of good, and if you found just the right combination, you'd be fine for a little while. If you take something, you either are, feel, or act better, and that's the lesson of my childhood. If you take something, you either are, feel, or act better. And, you know, that was what was happening in the 50s during my childhood. What was it like? The reality is I don't remember a lot of it. My using was kind of like Monterey Pop Festival. I was there. I don't remember a thing. Except kind of vaguely wandering around going, And I was like that for 3 or 4 days that time. Some friends of mine found me and stuck me in a blacklight room till I came down. And that's kind of what it was like. Or the man landing on the moon. We just went through this on TV, you know. And I nodded out and missed it. They had made a big deal at work, brought a TV in. We stopped working, sitting around the TV, and I'm going, had to watch the reruns. That's what it was like. I missed my teenage years. The last year of my using brought me to Narcotics Anonymous. There's a series of events that took place that compelled me into the doors of Narcotics Anonymous. In December of 1969, my girlfriend gave birth to a boy, and we gave that child up for adoption. And it was a real hard thing to do because I really wanted that kid. But I had come to the realization that I couldn't promise to be around to help raise that child. And that was one of those first moments where the reality of my addiction hit me in the face. And I hated myself. I hated what would become of me. And I dealt with those feelings the same way I dealt with all the rest of my feelings. I used some more. And my addiction popped up just one more notch. Not too long after that, my grandmother died. She took too many Reds one night and slipped and fell and scalded to death in the shower. She was an addict too, I think. Death by addiction. You know, we don't call it that very often. Death by addiction. Yeah. And, you know, she left this house full of furniture, so I asked that gal to marry me. And we got married, and she was going to be this last link to sanity. And Lois and I are still married. We went on this trip last week to California together and had a ball together. We're counting down till our kids are gone. We celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary in June. In a lot of ways, I think that's more miraculous than staying clean 25 years. I know that if I don't use nothing, no matter what, I'm not going to get loaded. I don't know how to stay married for 25 years. I know it takes a lot of stubbornness, it takes a lot of compromise, and it takes a lot of respect. And it takes some other things too, but I'm not as clear on that. I know how to stay clean. I can do that today. I might not be able to do that tomorrow, but I can do it today. We're here together. We're staying clean right now. This is all it takes. This is all it takes right now. It isn't any more complicated than sitting in a room together, being together, sharing with each other, meeting each other as equals, loving each other. That's all it takes. And don't use nothing no matter what. Following that, my best friend died. And he left a note that said, "I just can't think anymore." He hung himself. And on my wedding day, I was supposed to be the pallbearer at his funeral. And I didn't go to his funeral. I got loaded and got married and never said goodbye to him. And I understood his note that said, "I just can't think anymore," because I've been there. Because I've been praying for the comfort of idiocy. Remember praying? If I just didn't have to think anymore, if I could just turn it off. He got it. I couldn't get that. I didn't have any time off for bad behavior. I was never arrested. I was never hospitalized. I was never taken to the emergency room for an OD. I thought those were just good nods. My friends did dump me out of the back of a car one time because they thought I was dead, though. That was fun. I was pissed. Out in the boonies, and having to walk home. It was a drag, I tell you. I was cold. But anyway, I share often about something that occurred probably sometime in the summer, late summer of 1970. I don't know exactly when, but I was sitting backwards on a toilet, as I so often did, sick. And I couldn't get a vein. And I was dripping blood on the floor, going, "God damn, look what's become of me. Look at me. This is not the way it was supposed to turn out." And I hated myself. And I loathed what I had become. And you got a time just like that. I don't know what it is, and there are all kinds of things it might be. It might be having a friend die in your arms. Maybe giving up a child. Might be stealing from your grandparents. Might be selling bad drugs to a friend. It may be going to prison one more time or going to jail one more time. You know, it may be standing on the corner and the man says, "Put your hands on top of the car and spread your legs." It may be, but you got a time when you hated who you'd become, or you wouldn't be here. And I hope you never forget that time. And I hope it makes you want to cry when you think of it. And recognize you never have to go back to that place. You never have to feel like that again. There are times when I stayed clean just so I never had to feel that way again. Just so I never had to feel that emptiness, that loneliness, and that self-hate. When the reality of my addiction was staring me in the face. And I realized that little kid who had a dream, who had lots of dreams, had lost those dreams. And all that was left was using. And that wasn't cutting. And I continued to use. In October of 1970, I called probably a suicide line. I'd gotten to the point where I was calling the things in the middle of the night. And they said, "Are you eligible for Narcotics Anonymous?" I said, "I don't know. What do you got to be?" And they said, "Well, we don't know either, but here's this phone number. Why don't you call it? Sound like you might be a candidate." And, you know, and I called. And the man who answered the phone said, "Do you have a car?" And I'm really still not sure quite to this day whether he was asking me if I had a car to find out whether or not I had transportation, or whether he was asking me if I had a car to find out if I could give transportation, because there weren't a lot of cars in Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous is not what it was today. There were maybe 200 people going to meetings. There were perhaps 20 meetings in the world. There were 10 meetings in Southern California. There were probably 6 in Northern California. And there might have been a scattered, short-lived meeting, a few of them, elsewhere. And that's all Narcotics Anonymous was. And they said, "Well, come to one of our meetings." And I said, "Okay, what do I, you know?" And I promised the guy, and you know, I'm a promiser. I was a promiser. I had several good games when I was out there using. One of them was to present you with just the right information so you'd come to the conclusion that I wanted you to. Oh, some of you are good at that too. Another one was promise, and I was a good promiser. My follow-through was a little funny. Follow-through was real funny. But I was a good promiser, and I promised this guy I'd come to that meeting. It was on a Thursday night. Actually, this was a Tuesday that I called. And at that point, I was kicking, and I was not going to drive to any meeting. The meeting was about 50 miles away, and I declined. There was a meeting closer to where I lived on Thursday, and I promised I'd go. And I followed through with that. And I got all dressed up. I wore a black suit and tie. And, you know. There were going to be drug addicts at this meeting. You know, you understand, don't you? I mean, I'd read about drug addicts. Yeah. I read Naked Lunch. And I saw Reefer Madness when they were showing it for real. And I wasn't like that. And I just knew that there were going to be these horrible people, you know, at this meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. God. You know, some of you felt that way when you first, you know, you're going to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and going, "Give me a break," you know. What? But it's true. That's the way I felt. I was scared to death. And so I got all dressed. I bathed. That was a big deal. It really was. I bathed. And got all dressed up and went to this meeting, and I sat around. There's this square of tables and maybe about 20 people there, and I don't remember much. I remember they called on me, and I probably said something like, I might have a little problem, because I mumbled a lot when I was getting loaded. That's kind of what it was like too. I sat in a corner and I mumbled, and every once in a while I said something comprehensible or more or less or less or less. And that kind of, I didn't want to commit myself, and I was very, very afraid. And I heard people talking about Folsom Prison and Atascadero State Hospital and quarter-size holes drilled in their heads after the shock treatments, and I'm going, "Oh my God, what have I gotten myself into?" And I heard someone say, "You never have to use again against your will." And there was a little part of me that went, and that meant something to me. You never ever have to use again against your will. And I didn't tell anybody that I'd been using against my will. I'd been using when I was promising myself I was going to stop. I'd been using even though I hated myself a little bit more each time. I'd been using even when I couldn't stand it anymore. I hadn't told them that. And you know, there were a lot of those things in those early days that I heard people say in meetings that I'd never shared with anyone. I heard someone say, probably a little later on, they said, I've always felt both inferior and superior to everybody. And I'd never told anybody I felt that way because I thought it was crazy. How can you feel both inferior and superior at the same time? But I did. And it was through people saying stuff like that in meetings without knowing that I felt that way that I came to believe that I was an addict, that I came to believe that Narcotics Anonymous might work for me. Because I certainly didn't come here thinking that I qualified. I was just this nice kid who used every day for 15 years, and, you know, I had a little problem. And, you know, if I could just quit using for long enough, then maybe I could get off again, get loaded again, and the drugs would work again. I didn't come here because I had a desire to stop using. I had a desire to have the drugs work again. And I figured if I cleaned up, it'd be okay. I don't know very many people, you know, who came with a desire to stop using. How many of you guys have worried, I didn't really come with a desire to stop using? Did you worry about that? When you heard about, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using? I don't think anybody comes the first time with a desire to stop using. Hardly. Some people come back with a desire to stop using. I mean, when you guys started sharing, and I snapped to the fact you were talking about things like this as a program of complete abstinence from all drugs, I was going, excuse me? Are you sure? Are we talking about the same thing? You know, I tried to disqualify myself right away as soon as you started talking about shit like that, because that's not what I was here for. You know, I was here, you know, because I couldn't continue to live the way I was living. I was here because it hurt bad. And I think almost all of us come, you know, to ease the pain, to get out of trouble, to get someone off our back, to please somebody, to kick a habit, to get the judge off our case, to get out of prison, whatever it happens to be. But very, very few of us come for the first time because we have this great desire to stop using. That comes if we stay clean. I believe that we need to develop that if we're going to stay clean. And today I have a desire to stay clean, and I have a desire to continue to live life without the use of drugs. I went through what we all go through. You know, scared to death. I used twice after I came to the program. I came to my first meeting on a Thursday night. I used the first time the following Sunday night behind lack of sleep. I hadn't slept at all in a week. I used the following Sunday night because, you see, I'd come back to Narcotics Anonymous after that time I used, and I'd been properly embarrassed. You know, and they embarrassed you back in those days. You know, there weren't that many people, and when you screwed up, everybody knew. And they talk bad about you in meetings. They point their finger at you and say, you ain't going to make it, chump. Or here's a book of matches. Go burn yourself out. There's this one guy named Jack Whaley, who's dead now, who used to say, you relapsed. You went out there. You betrayed me. Don't talk to me for a year. Yeah. I mean, that's what it was like. And, you know, there's a part of me that's real grateful. It was a hard-line time in Narcotics Anonymous. I'm also grateful that we're not quite that hard on each other today. I do get very, and I say this almost every time I share, because it's something that I think is important to say. It really, really bothers me when I see us pat our returnees on the back and tell them it's okay, because it ain't okay. I bet my life on a Narcotics Anonymous that said I never ever have to use again against my will. I bet my life on a Narcotics Anonymous that said that I don't have to go back. And I don't believe that relapse is part of recovery. I hear people say that every once in a while. I go, oh, God, you know. Relapse is not part of recovery. Relapse is part of the disease. And yes, we have a relapsing disease, but relapse has absolutely nothing to do with recovery. It's kind of like people talking about how painful recovery is. Bullshit. Recovery is not painful. It's lack of recovery that's painful. When I am nuts, when I am crazy, when I've got my guts hanging out, insane, it's not because my program is real good right then. It's not because I've made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. It's not because I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs. It's because I'm not doing those things. It's lack of recovery that's painful. And yet I hear people talk about that, and I hear people come back, and we pat them on the back. If you're coming back from a relapse, and I realize that there are probably some of you that are, I love you. Welcome back. Don't do that again, dummy. And it ain't okay. And you know the funny thing? If you're coming back, you know it ain't okay. If you've been out and back, you are well aware that it wasn't okay. When I came around, I tried to disqualify myself. I looked for all the differences. I told you I heard people talking about prison, and I never did that, and I moved back, or I moved away from them. Heard people talk about mental institutions, move away from them. Heard people talking about finding NA on death row, and move back a row. Heard people talking about this, heard people talking about that. I found myself in the back of the room. The second time I used around Narcotics Anonymous was behind a 12-step call. I had a week clean at the time. And I went and got one of my using buddies and told him about this wonderful thing I'd found, Narcotics Anonymous. And you never ever have to use again. And I took him to a meeting. You taught me to take him to a meeting, right? We teach each other to go take him to a meeting. I took him to a meeting. It was, you know, he said, this was bullshit. I'm going home and getting loaded. And I said, you can't do that, because if you do that, I got to go with you. And you'll wreck my recovery. And we did. And I came back and was again promptly embarrassed. See, they used to say, do we have any newcomers here within the first 30 days? And you had to stand up in front of everybody. And everybody knew there was no place to hide in NA. You couldn't go to some town down the road 20, 30 miles in some obscure meeting and pick up a white key tag or a white chip and pawn it off, you know. How many of you guys have had someone come up to you and or been up to someone and you know they're due for a birthday? Huh? And they said, oh, I had to adjust my clean time about 6 months ago, and you didn't have any idea, huh? There was no place to hide. Everyone knew when you messed up. And there was no place to hide. Part of me misses that. But there also weren't a lot of people staying clean. I suspect that what we have today is much, 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 much better than that. Because look around. There are a lot of people staying clean. There's a lot of help available and a lot of spirit available in this room. And that wasn't true when I came around. At 30 days, it was kind of like I'd found a new drug. Remember that? Yeah, I was getting high off of not getting high, and it was so good not to have somebody on my ass every minute, not to have to look over my shoulder, not to be sick in the morning. After like 4 weeks, I slept a whole night. Remember the first time you slept a whole night? God, it was great, wasn't it? And I felt good, and this, wow, it was great, and I loved it, and that, just like getting high off of not getting high. And I got enthusiastic about Narcotics Anonymous, and all we had was the little white booklet, so I memorized it. Somebody was talking about memorizing earlier. I memorized it, word for word, and I talk long shit. The therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. I'd say stuff like that, have no idea what it meant, but I'd say it good. Yeah, I'd say it good. Or you know, there is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. That's one of the truest statements I have ever heard. I had no appreciation of it at the time. I just said that stuff. Ask me any question. I had all the answers. 90 days, I had all the answers. I mean, there aren't that many answers. It's all in the white book. The white booklet is the italicized portion of the basic text, basically. And all the answers are there. That's all we had my first few years of recovery. Basic text came out in 1983. I was 13 years clean. If you have read the basic text and really looked at it and tried to learn from it, you know more than I knew my first 10 years about recovery. And that's kind of like someone, like the person who was asking me, what's it like to have 25 years clean? There's no real comparison. I mean, I got what I got. Shortly after I had all the answers, the big blue bird of feelings flew over. And I became the windshield. And, you know, I hear people talking about the lifting of a veil, and that's not what it was like. All of a sudden, I was engulfed in these feelings that I had no way to deal with. And they were not particularly pleasant. And I couldn't tell the pleasant ones from the unpleasant ones. And I'd sit around trying to figure out why I was crazy while I was crazy. And it was really insane. It was really nuts. It was really, you know, I was in trouble. And at 6 months, I'm going, oh my God, it's not the drugs. That was one of the first devastating realizations I had in recovery. Is that it's not the drugs. I mean, here I was, I'd been clean 6 months, and guess what? I didn't feel like I'd changed at all. I didn't feel like things were any different. I felt like things were just as messed up as they had been before. And I'm going, oh, shit. What do I do now? And for me, the answer is called substitution. It's not the answer. But that's the one I found. And I started substituting everything I could to cover those feelings. You see, because if I could focus hard enough on something outside myself, I didn't have to feel that stuff. If I could focus hard enough on work, then I didn't have to feel those feelings. If I could focus hard enough on sex, I didn't have to feel those feelings. If I could focus hard enough on a hobby, I didn't have to feel those feelings. If I could focus hard enough on food, then I didn't have to feel those feelings. If I could focus hard enough on reading, then I didn't have to feel those feelings. I could get obsessed with this stuff, and it fixed me for a while. And I played it to the hilt. And I used that as long as it worked. You know, I used that through my first year. You know, when you're going, oh my God, if I stay clean another week, then I'll have made it. What do I do now? Sabotage. You know, or right after a year, boy, I'm glad that's over with. Now I can get back to living like a real person. I can have a relationship. Oh, God. I mean, that is one of my least favorite things I hear. No relationships in the first year. What's so magical about the 366th day? Most of us at 366 days are somewhat sicker than we were at about 250 days. Because we're dead off in the birthday crazies. We don't know how to have relationships. You know, relationships, God. I believe in relationships. I just don't think we're very good lovers. I mean, we're really handicapped in the realm of intimacy. We're really handicapped in the realm of love. We are really handicapped when it comes to finding a partner to share life with. We don't do that well at all. Now, we talk long shit about it. But we are really very, very inept at those things. It's kind of like we talk long shit about how good our programs are, right? It's easy for me to stand up here and tell you how good my program is. But the reality is, my program's only as good as it is when you ain't here. Don't tell me how good your program is. Show me by the way you live. I'm much more interested in how's your life than how's your program. See, because your life is a manifestation of your program. The way we live determines the way we live. It's a principle called reciprocity. The way you live determines the way you live. How are you living? Well, I was in trouble when I first thought of that one or was exposed to that idea. How are you living? I mean, is your life full of negativity? Full of dishonesty? Are you using and abusing your friends? Is there a lot of disease in your life? Stop living that way. The way you live determines the way you live. Or does your life speak well of recovery? If you don't like the way your life is going, change the way you live. What a concept. It's really true. Positive actions yield positive results. Negative actions yield negative results. It's a given. It always works that way. All but I can get away with it this time, no one will know. There is no getting away with anything. If you're pulling a sleaze play, your life is full of sleaze. Oops. We've all done it. We all do it, huh? If your life is full of dishonesty, if you're being dishonest, your life is full of dishonesty. Oops, we all do it. If you're being negative, your life's full of negativity. Oops, we all do it. The way you live determines the way you live. If you don't like the way your life's going, change the way you live. But it took me a long time to come to terms with that. You know, and I went through all the stuff. Relationships. Addiction is the antithesis of love. The reason that we're horrible lovers is because we spent a lifetime living in contradiction to love. I believe in the disease concept, the threefold, you know, when your whole life and thinking is centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. You've probably read that somewhere or at least heard it. Does that sound like there's room for another human being? Not in my life. Now, I could tolerate being around somebody after I was loaded. And I did some partying with people after I was loaded. I did a lot of things after I was loaded. And there was a lot of things that I couldn't do before I was loaded. There were a lot of things that I couldn't cope with, like feelings, until I got loaded. And every love affair I ever had was predestined to failure because as soon as it started getting intimate, I started sabotaging it. Or the mental aspect of the disease. You know how we tend to get strung out at anything? Someone said at the World Convention in San Francisco in 77, we don't have relationships, we take hostages. Yeah. And my problem was that I didn't fall in love with people. I got obsessed with them. And obsession and love are mutually exclusive. They cannot coexist. It's kind of like helping and enabling. Obsession and enabling are both selfish acts. They're not about the other person. They're about me. Me! Love and helping are unselfish acts. So when I've obsessed with someone, it ain't about them. It's a selfish act. And my relationships, my love affairs prior to recovery were about selfishness. And I don't know anybody in here who does it any different. Now sometimes we play the victim role, and sometimes we play the doormat role, and sometimes we play the aggressor role, and sometimes we do this and sometimes we do that, but it's all self-obsession. And as a result, I never loved. And not only that, I have this the spiritual lack of faith, lack of hope, lack of trust, inability to relate to others as equals, obsession with self, low self-esteem. See, and I'm instantly attracted to the worst possible person for me. I get hot flashes over that person that's going to confirm my low self-esteem. I am drawn like a moth to a flame to that relationship where I can end up saying, see, I told you I was no good. No one could ever love me. See, I told you I'd always hurt anyone who loved me. See, I told you I'd always be hurt by anyone who loved me. And I'd seek out people who would confirm that low self-esteem. And you know what? So did you. If any of you had any relatively happy long-term relationships, chances are it was blind luck. My marriage was. We got married for all the wrong reasons. And you know, somewhere in the first 5 years of my recovery, we had to find a reason to stay together. We had to put our marriage on hold and find a reason to be together. And we did, and I'm grateful for that. I really enjoy my marriage today. Like I said, we've been married 25 years. I've also been monogamous for over 25 years. I think there's a relationship between the two. My experience that there is a relationship between the two. I do believe that there's some relationships we need to have right away, and I'm going to talk about them, and I usually talk about them. There are five specifically that I want to talk about. The first one is called honesty. It's a relationship with ourselves and with reality. There are two types of honesty that are critical. You know, we even list that one. There are three things that seem indispensable. These are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to try. Honesty. I had no idea what it meant. I had been dishonest for so long that I didn't even have a feel for it. Honesty has something to do with accuracy in word and deed. First of all, cash register honesty. Don't lie, cheat, or steal. And I didn't know how to do that. I was a petty thief. I could not go in a store without stealing something. And I had to practice cash register honesty and practice and practice and practice. Now, I wasn't a big-time thief. I stole cigarettes and candy bars and I relapsed on that for many years after I came around Narcotics Anonymous. It was very, very difficult for me to stop stealing. It's very difficult for me to stop cheating on my taxes. It was very difficult for me to stop lying, because I'd gotten to the point where I would lie for no reason at all, even when it wasn't necessary. And I'd gotten to the point where I believed my lies. My first inventory included a whole scenario on my taking somebody who'd ripped me off out to the curb and breaking out both his wrists. And that never happened. I thought I needed something gory to talk about in order to qualify for Narcotics Anonymous. It never happened. Even my first inventory contained lies, because I was trying to impress the person I was going to do a fifth step with, because I was trying to be accepted, because I was desperate for acceptance. And that brings me to the second type of honesty. You see, I was so desperate for acceptance that I'd never ever let you know who I was. I would never ever let you know my big secret. And I always share my big secret. Not always, but usually. My big secret is the same as your big secret. And I'm going to say it out loud. Way down deep inside of me, there's this kid who doesn't know how to live, who's been faking it, who's scared to death, and worst of all, is vulnerable. And you can hurt me without ever knowing. That's my big secret. And I know it's your big secret too. I don't have anybody raising their hand saying, but. Yeah, it's true. That's our big secret. That's the one thing we never, ever wanted anybody to find out. Because if you ever knew what I was like way down deep inside, there'd be no way you could accept me, right? If cash register honesty weren't bad enough, I got to get real with you. I got to let you in. I need to be vulnerable to you in order to really experience this relationship called honesty. And that's terrifying to me. That has always been terrifying to me. The second relationship I think is critical is called fellowship. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. NA is not about an hour or an hour and a half in the evening. NA is a way of living. A way of living by utilizing spiritual principles to deal with what life gives us. I mean, the last 5-6 years of my life, I have had more adversity than I did the first 19, 20, 17. I don't know exactly the numbers. For the first 10 years around here, it seemed like everything I touched turned to gold. It was great. I experienced my first failure in recovery, real failure, at about 12 years clean. At 9 years clean, my wife and I and our son moved to Oregon because we didn't want to raise our kids in the war zone. We had a dream of having a school for kids with learning disabilities. And we fell flat on our face and lost everything we'd worked 10 years for. And we picked up the pieces and ended up moving to Georgia, of all damn places. And things started going real good in Georgia. 17 years, I was driving home from work one day, and I made a conscious decision to ram the car next to me on the interstate. That was about the last time I came up here and talked, a little after, I think. And I started talking to myself, as I so often do, and I said, "Greg, this is really, really crazy. You could get hurt doing this. What you need to do is go home and get your gun and go blow somebody away." And I went home and loaded my gun. I ended up giving my car keys and selling my guns. And from that point on, I could no longer say that nicotine withdrawal was no big deal. And it's somewhere around 19 or 20 years clean, Slick Greg got ripped off for $100,000. And lost everything. And we found ourselves homeless. by choice, we put everything in storage. And went on a road trip, finding a new start, one more time, start all over, huh? And ended up in Tennessee, of all places, as director of a treatment center that lasted about 90 days. Then I was unemployed for 14 months and ended up going to work for the state of Tennessee. I run a drug program in a juvenile prison, which is bizarre. I never ever thought I'd end up working for the establishment or behind the walls. When I was doing H&I work in 1970 and 71 and 72, I never in my wildest dreams did I think I was going to end up working, behind the walls. But you know, just for today, that's what I'm doing. Financially, the last 5 years have been disastrous again. This last March, my daughter came running down the stairs and said, "Something's wrong with Clay, my son." And he was unconscious on the floor of his bedroom, thrashing around behind meningitis. And we took him to the emergency room, and he was unconscious for 3 days. And he's fine today. I'd like to give you an example of, don't tell me how good your program is, show me by the way you live. And the example is that Lois and I didn't have to get crazy behind that. We were able to call 911. We were able to go to the emergency room. We were able to do what was necessary. They ended up not turning him off chemically because he was thrashing and he'd torn up his leg with the restraints. And they shut him off. And he was not going to regain consciousness for many hours. And we went to a meeting. And I called my sponsor. This program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. With all the adversity of the last 5 years, it hasn't been necessary for me to lose hope. It hasn't been necessary to make things worse, because I'm an expert at making things worse, just like you are. We can take minor problems and make them into calamities, catastrophes. I am an expert at making things worse. And you know, with all the adversity, that hasn't been necessary. And I haven't lost faith. And to me, that's a miracle. To me, that is almost an unfathomable miracle. Except I worked on practicing these principles. I practiced and practiced and practiced. So when the shit hit the fan, I was in the habit of applying these principles. And it carried me through. Part of that is being a part of. If you're sitting in here and you don't feel like you're a part of, shame on you. Chances are you're not. If you want to feel like you're part of this, be part of this. If you want to feel like an NA member, do the things that NA members do. Get involved. Do something other than an hour and a half at night. Get to know some people. Get vulnerable. Stay after a meeting. Talk to somebody. Ask somebody, what did you mean when you said that? You know, when you were going, I got my shit together. I don't ask questions. Remember? Stand out in the parking lot, even when it's cold. And share about recovery and learn about recovery. And invite someone over to dinner at your house. Break bread together. It's really nice. Rent a movie. Don't go with a car full of addicts to the movie store, though. Unless you're going to do that at this week's entertainment for a movie you're going to watch next week. Become a part of. The only way to feel like a part of is to be a part of. Fellowship. Part of the reason that Narcotics Anonymous works is we let go of our selfish self-centeredness and become part of a greater whole. I can't, we can. Part of the reason that Narcotics Anonymous is that we surrender our self-obsession and become part of a greater whole. I can't, we can. I said that twice in case you missed it the first time. Yeah. The third relationship that I think is critical is called sponsorship. Anybody here looking for a sponsor? I wish you the best of luck. If you're looking for just that perfect sponsor, forget it. I already told you everybody has defects, right? The person you pick is going to have defects. Find somebody who demonstrates recovery by the way they live. Now, if you pick a complete fool as a sponsor, they can't hardly screw up your life any worse than you already have. If you don't want to ask anybody to be your sponsor, don't do it. If you don't want to write a fourth step, don't do it. As long as you can stand it. If you don't want to make amends, you don't have to make amends. It don't say anywhere that you got to do that shit. As long as you can stand it. It's like somebody I sponsor comes to me and says, I don't think I'm ready for that yet. And I go, okay. You'll learn. And invariably, you know, 3 or 4 months down the road, it says, can you teach me something? You know, I swear, if you procrastinate long enough, you'll beg. Apathy and procrastination seem to be two of our inherent enemies. That's what kind of what that means, you know. And, you know, if you find somebody who's trying to live this way and whose life seems to be about recovery instead of about sickness, you're going to be okay. And yeah, you're going to make your first overtures and you're going to put forth your tests. It's okay to give your sponsor little tests, give pieces of the puzzle just to make sure he or she doesn't reject you, you know. Lots of people do that, as long as you can stand it. Yeah. And you know what? If nothing else, your sponsor is not prejudiced about you. See, I got a problem. Everything I think about Greg and Greg's life is prejudiced by my experience, by my fears, by my hopes, by my past, by my dreams, by the things I learned when I was a kid. I am incapable about being objective about Greg. I am incapable about being objective about me. I can't do that. That's why I got to have a sponsor. Because my sponsor can be objective about Greg. My sponsor don't have all that lust and shit mixed up in his life. He just has what I give him. I have a sponsor. I believe in sponsorship. I sponsor people. It is probably the most important service, sponsorship and being a sponsor, see, that we do. Sponsorship and being sponsored are the most important form of service that we do, I think. Because you see, those things feed directly into the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. And it's a special, special, special relationship. Don't look too hard for just the right higher power. I mean, if you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of nothing, you're going to get chance, which is 50-50, right? How good do you do when you run your life? Do you get 50-50? do you get 10% maybe? I might get 10%. I might guess right 1 out of 10 times when I'm running it. But chance is 50-50. So, you know, I'm so worried about finding the right higher power. You know, we take all this stuff so seriously. You know, we get stuck trying to figure it all out. Right? We got a step that says, you know, knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. We spent years trying to figure out God's will for us, right? What I've learned in 25 years is if you got to stop and figure it out, you miss the point. It ain't that complicated, you know. But some of the lessons that were important to me early on were things like, there ain't no big deals. It ain't important enough to get loaded over. Trust your experience. I mean, I've got 25 years of experience that says every single time I trust my higher power and get the hell out of the way, things turn out just fine. And every time I'm faced with that decision, I'm going, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, what can I do instead of that? Surrender is still does not make any sense. It is an irrational act. Because if it was rational, we'd pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and control ourselves. Right? Take charge of my life. When I take charge of my life ends up looking like an ashtray. or something worse. really, I can't do that. Surrender is irrational, but still. Again, surrender is one of those things that we think of as being painful, right? Surrender is not painful. Surrender is a wonderful release. Surrender is the ultimate relief. It's when I'm struggling and fighting surrender and refusing to surrender and holding on to self-will with my fingernails and my teeth and my life is like fingernails on a blackboard. That's when it's painful. When I finally give up control and go, okay, God, I give up. Then I get some, and it's kind of like a pee when you really got to go. Now, peeing when you really got to go is not painful. It's relief. Hold it, it's painful. And I'm talking about those pees that, you know, for us guys, it's when our knees get weak. And for you gals, it's when you melt into the toilet seats. You know what I mean. We've all been there on road trips, huh? Yeah, you know. That's surrender. And my life is full of surrenders that are even simpler than that. You know, I get up in the morning and one of the first things I have to do at some point is surrender the comfort of that bed. I'm driving down the road and to the right is work and to the left is the lake. I have to make a decision and a surrender or else I'm going to crash and burn. Now, I don't know which way I'll decide and which surrender I'll make. But I got to do it. You know? Life is full of surrenders. And we think we make such big deal of surrender, don't we? Oh, I can't surrender. No, no, anything but that. I'm here to tell you, there is no substitute for surrender. There is no way you can avoid that. Now, you can hold on to shit as long as you can stand it. I say that a lot, don't I? But sooner or later, there is no substitute for surrender. And we spend years trying to find one. Each and every one of us spend years and tremendous amounts of energy searching for a substitute for surrender. There is no substitute for surrender. The fourth relationship that I think is critical, it's called integrity. One of the dictionary definitions of that is strict adherence to a moral code. It means live this way. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. Live this way. We have a moral code in Narcotics Anonymous. Integrity means living that way. We also have some morals around here that aren't written down anywhere. Like, for instance, it ain't okay to do things that prevent another person from getting clean. It ain't okay to use and abuse each other. It ain't okay to continue living in the disease. But we do. And we wonder why we end up feeling like we don't belong. Because we violate the moral code that's here in Narcotics Anonymous. Unwritten, though it is. It ain't okay to deny each other recovery. It ain't okay to latch on to somebody, you know, with claws and do whatever is necessary to prevent them from getting any better, because if they do, they might not like you. And we all do that at times. But it ain't okay. Relationship number 5, spirituality. It's about a relationship with my beliefs. It's about living a different way. It's about letting go of my death grip on life and finding something to believe in. Honesty, fellowship, sponsorship, integrity, spirituality. If we have those 5 things going for us, we got a chance. Those are 5 relationships we need as soon as we can get them. Don't wait a year for those relationships. If you want to find out when you can take a lover in this program or get intimate with somebody, my suggestion is write a good 4th step and do a good 5th step. Learn the rules first. So you don't have to continue violating yourself and seeking out that person that will confirm your low self-esteem. Do a good 4th and 5th step. If you can do that in 6 months or 9 months, fine. If it takes you 3 to 5 years to do that, fine. This is not a race. If you're working quick to get through the steps, realize that you're going to be working on this shit the rest of your life. I hope. And it's not a race. Your recovery is only as good as your recovery. How's your recovery? Don't tell me how good you're doing. Show me by the way you live. My greatest growth in the last few years has come in this area of spirituality. My relationship with the 2nd step has changed radically. And I'm going to share about this. And that's changed my understanding of the rest of the steps. The first time I looked at the 2nd step, I rubber stamped it like we most of us do. Got that? What's next? Then I whipped out my 3rd step prayer and said it 4 million times. Sorry. Actually, that worked. It worked for a while. But I found out there's much more to the 2nd step than that. And I went down the path I see most of us going down. Come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Power greater than ourselves. That must be this higher power thing that everybody talks about, right? Okay, come to believe that my higher power can restore me. You know, this is really a sneaky program. In the 3rd step, it says God. They really want me to come and believe in God. And boy, I don't want to do that. When I came here, I had God labeled, categorized, defined, placed up on a shelf for further reference, just in case I might need that shit someday. That was my experience. I'd explain God to my satisfaction in some of the psych courses I'd had when I was in college. And didn't have any kind of relationship. Okay, I come to believe that God can restore me to sanity. Well, sanity. The craziest thing I've ever done is the way I acted when I was using. So, I come to believe that God can fix my addiction. And that was my 2nd step for a lot of years, when I took away all the excess stuff. That's what my 2nd step boiled down to. Today, I do not believe that that's the second step. I believe it may well be true, but I don't believe that's what the second step says today. Because I had to look at this thing called sanity, and my experience over the last few years has taught me a lot about sanity and insanity. One of the first things I noticed when I got ripped off for $100,000, I gave myself permission to eat, knowing that I hate myself in the morning. In our basic text, it says insanity is repeating the same mistakes and expecting different results. But that's not what I did. That's a good definition of denial. I've learned that for me, even crazier than that, is repeating the same mistakes, knowing what the results are going to be, and go ahead and do it anyway. Consciously choosing the self-destructive path. Hooking up with a relationship that you know is a sick relationship. Hooking up with an obsession that you know is destructive. Hooking up with something that you know where it will take you, but having to do it anyway. And that's more the nature of my insanity than repeating the same mistakes expecting different results. And I had to look at sanity. What is this thing? And I went back to the simplest thing I could think of. A person who is insane is a person who is out of touch with reality. I said it earlier. A person who's living life like fingernails on a blackboard. A person who is living in contradiction with reality, in disharmony with principles, living in negativity, in dishonesty, in selfishness. That's insane. A person who is sane is a person who is living in harmony with reality, who's practicing spiritual principles. And what is reality? Ultimately, reality is God. So God's moved from the center of the second step to the end of the second step for me. But that left me with a little dilemma. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore my relationship with reality, my relationship with God. But what's that? Our program is a set of principles written so simply that I can follow them in my daily life. Today, my second step boils down to I come to believe that this process, that living the NA way, can restore my relationship with reality, can restore my spirituality, can restore my sanity. And that's changed the whole picture. My third step today, instead of being a commitment to work the rest of the steps, is about living life as if I really believed that there was a loving God that would care for me. It's about risking recovery. Living life insecure in the knowledge that there is a loving God that will care for me. But most of all, living life. Don't tell me how good your program is. Show me by the way you live. And my fourth step, instead of being show and tell, you know. Hey, I had to come to grips with the fact that my first two or three fourth steps were not fourth steps. They were more about the unmanageability of my life and chronicling that. They didn't have a lot to do with an assessment of my morality. The fourth step says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It's time I learn what the rules are for Greg. It's time that I learn about those things that keep me from growing spiritually. It's a time that I learn about the patterns that I have repeated again and again and again and again, which have kept me from being a real person, that have kept me sick, that have kept me in disease, that have kept me insane. And that's what a fourth and fifth step are about, learning about those. And my defects and shortcomings become expressions of those things which inhibit spiritual growth. And in the sixth step, I become entirely ready to have God remove these defects. And in the seventh step, I humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And what I'm really asking for is to God, to have God remove those things that keep me from growing spiritually. And that's one of three petitions I make in the course of the steps. In the third step, I ask for God to take care of me. I made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. And in the seventh step, I ask for change. I ask to be relieved of those things that keep me from growing. And the 11th step, I ask for knowledge and power. Not personal power, not self-will, spiritual power, spiritual direction. So, 6 and 7 become a process of getting real about why I'm stuck. And 8 and 9, the amend steps, are about getting rid of some of that stuff that keeps me stuck. The biggest mistake I made in amends was thinking it was for them. It's irrelevant how the person I'm making amends to receives it. It's about me forgiving me. It's about me letting go of being stuck. It's about me setting aside those things that I carry that keep me from growing spiritually. It's not about whether or not someone says, oh, that's okay. It doesn't matter what they say. I've got to do what I've got to do to keep growing. Because if I'm not growing, I'm dying. If I am not growing spiritually, I am dying. And the 10th step, instead of being, you know, look at the day at the end of the day, although that's part of it, becomes a monitoring process. And I learn from those lessons and those things that keep me from going. When I watch for them, I look for the signs in my life. Driving down the road, 100 miles an hour. The first thing I got to do is slow down a little bit. Next thing I have to do is open my eyes. If I'm not driving quite so fast, I don't have to be so afraid I keep them closed. And I see these signs, you know. Or used to be I'd run down the road, and all of a sudden I'd crash and burn off the end of a bridge. Yap, yap, bam. Yeah, I'd do that. And then after a while, it slowed down a little bit, and I could see this thing. There was this thing. There's a sign. And I became more aware of some of those things. And I'd almost be able to read the sign before I crashed and burned. And today, much of the time, I can see the sign and slow up before I go off the end of the bridge. That's really nice. It doesn't hurt anywhere near as bad if I can stop and change directions. See, and the 10th step becomes a monitoring process. It means balance. The purpose of the 10th step is to adjust to what life gives you using spiritual principles. The reason we continue to take personal inventory and be aware, if the 4th step is self-assessment, then perhaps the 10th step is self-awareness. The reason we continue to take personal inventory is so we can adjust to what life gives us by using a set of principles written so simply we can follow them in our daily lives. We practice these principles in all our affairs. And we maintain balance. That's balance. Balance isn't what I thought about. You know, I used to think balance was nobody move, click, a place for everything and everything in its place. Who's always moving? It's the broom on your hand that's always moving. It's a continual adjustment to life using spiritual principles. And that's the purpose of the 10th step. And 11, prayer and meditation. Life is all about prayer and meditation. I have come to believe, and somebody was talking about this earlier, and they heard it somewhere early on, and it scared the shit out of them. It scared the shit out of me, too. When I came to the realization that life was all about prayer and meditation, and I considered the possibility that everything I did was a form of prayer. And everything I thought was a form of meditation. I had a sponsor for many years who gave me a quote out of a book that said, the greatest prayer someone can offer me. And it terrified me because I had to look at my life. What if your life's a prayer? And what if you get what you pray for? You hope not? Yeah, I heard it. Me too. You know, I'm into this pray for mercy, not for justice shit, you know. It's a good thing we get what we get instead of what we deserve. Yeah. Yeah. I suspect that it would behoove me. You like that word? It would behoove me to live my life as if it were a prayer. To live my life the best I can. Yeah. I would benefit from that. And if I can do that, and if I can maintain an attitude that says, God is all around me, that my higher power exists in each of you and every place, that God is omnipotent, omnipotent. If I can maintain that attitude, then consciousness and awareness becomes a form of meditation. If I can see God in all things, then awareness is meditation. Now, I don't do that good. But that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want my life to be prayer and meditation when I grow up. And the better I do that, the closer I get to God. The better I do that, the more fulfilled I feel. The better I do that, the better I am able to love. The better I do that, the happier I am. The better I do that, the less I violate myself. If anyone treated me the way I treat myself, I'd kill them. The better I am able to live life as a prayer and approach consciousness as meditation, the less I have to destroy myself. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that sounds just like the second step now. We try to carry this message to addicts. Don't tell me how good your program is, show me by the way you live. And practice these principles in all our affairs. Live this way. The way you live determines the way you live. And if we can do that, we get great gifts. We get to be okay to live in our bodies. You know, probably my biggest, most obvious defect is the fact that I medicate myself with food occasionally. But you know what? It's okay to be Greg. It's okay to live inside this body. It's okay to be 48 years old and gray and fat and lost my teeth and losing my eyes. You see, because today I got me. You know, I got me and I got my spirit. And I am able to love. And I'm able to care. And I'm able to hug someone and mean it. And those are wonderful, wonderful gifts. And you know what? Today my life means something. And so does yours. Every time that you're strong enough and have courage enough to reach out to someone in NA, to hug, to care, to share spirit to spirit, soul to soul. It gives meaning to your life. And people have become martyrs throughout history just to make their lives mean something. And we're given it on a silver platter. Just live this way. Take the time to love one another.